Good to see all of you this morning. If you would please open your Bibles to 1 Chronicles, chapter 17, 2 Chronicles, I did sound right. 2 Chronicles, chapter 17, and also put your marker at 2 Kings, about chapter 1 or so. We'll look some more at that in just a moment. We're talking about the period of Old Testament history, dealing with the divided kingdom. And we don't want to lose sight of things that we've talked about already, because when you're studying history, especially this Old Testament history, the episodes kind of build upon each other to bring about the thing that God promised to come about. And so we want to keep that in mind as we study. One of the problems that I've had when I was younger, especially, in studying the Bible is looking with tunnel vision. You know what that is? You ever look down the tube that the roll of paper towels is wrapped around, and you look down that tube, and that's all you can see. And so, consequently, you can't see the things that are round about. And sometimes our Bible study is that way. We study with tunnel vision. And when we do that, we don't see the relationship of the event that we're studying about, the relationship that that has to previous events that we've studied, or even events that are to come. And so we want to see the overall plan of God in this history and geography study. I want us to think a little bit about things that we have studied so far. I like to study with a timeline, as most of you know. And a timeline, you just simply draw a line and you put an open parenthesis on each end. On each end of that line, that represents eternity. But this in the middle is time. And a lot of things occur along that timeline relative to the development of God's plan to save man. Now, in the beginning, when God made man and placed him in the Garden of Eden, we see that he gave a commandment to him, "Thou shalt not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the day that thou eatest thereof," what did God say would happen? You'll die. That's right. In chapter 3, we see that Satan tempted Eve and she ate, and now imposed upon Eve, and as she gave unto her husband Adam, and he likewise did eat, is the consequence of sin. You've got the introduction now of something that didn't exist before. The introduction of sin. God, in his foresight and infinite wisdom, planned what to do when man would sin. And in the plan of God was the sending of his son, Jesus, who might die and provide a sacrifice of atonement sufficient to take away the sins of man. Now, that's what the Bible is about. We could just close it up and say, now we know that, we can just go home. But no, what we have tried to see is that in order for that to all come to pass, there is a lot of time involved in the development and the revelation of God's plan to save man. We've noted that from the time of Adam and Eve until the time of the flood, generations pass. And from the time of the flood to the time of the man named Abraham, generations pass. Many generations. And as we come to the time of Abraham, we know that God made a promise to Abraham, a threefold promise. What was it? Nation, land, and sea. Let's be more specific for those who have not been in our class. When we think about the nation promise, what was that, Carolyn?
He he promised to make Abraham a great nation, in other words, many descendants, and he gathered them and gave them law and made them be a chosen people.
All right. When God promised that unto Abraham, there's a problem. You're going to be the father of many nations, and in fact, the father of this particular nation. But what was the problem with Abraham?
He wasn't the father of even one.
He didn't have even children. Yeah. And we've got an approaching another problem. What was it?
He was 75.
He's old. Yeah. Well, he was 75. That's not old. But by the time he had Isaac, the promised child, how old was he? He was 100 years old. How old was Sarah? 90 years old. Boy. 90 years old. Carolyn, I see the expression on your face. Can you imagine having children at 90 years old? Randy, can you imagine being a daddy at 100 for the first time? Well, this was the promised child. Now, I know the story of Ishmael and all that, but this was the promised child. Isaac was born. Well, Isaac becomes a teenager about so, and what did God tell Abraham to do with his son, David? Sacrifice. Take thy son, thine only son, take him upon the mountain that I will show thee up, and offer him as a sacrifice. And that brings us to what chapter in Genesis? Genesis 22. That's right. Now, as we proceed on down through the process of time, we know that Abraham did not sacrifice his son. He attempted to or was ready to, but God provided him with a lamb, and we know, or a ram, and we know that Abraham's faith had been established, proven before God. Isaac grows up. He has two sons. What were their names? Jacob and Esau. We've got a fork in the family tree. Which fork did God choose? Chose Jacob. That's right. Jacob had 12 sons. Out of the sons that Jacob had, which fork did God choose?
Judah.
For the son. His God's son to come into the world. Judah. That's right. Yeah, he chose Judah to be the one through whom this lineage would come. Now, in the process of all of that, we've got a lot of events that transpire that make that happen. And as we read concerning the family of Jacob, we know the story of Joseph that fills about half of the book of Genesis. Joseph, one of the sons of Jacob, was hated by his brothers. What if they loved him? It would have changed the whole thing. We know that they did what to Joseph?
Sold him into slavery.
Where was he taken? Egypt. What if he was taken north instead of south? Would have changed the whole thing. But we know that when God spoke to Abraham, he told Abraham that you're going to have many descendants, and this land that I'm going to give you, I'm not going to let you have it personally. It's going to be in the fourth generation from now. But first, your descendants are going to become the servants of another nation, and I will bring them out with much substance. Well, while Joseph's down there in Egypt, we know that he grew through the ranks, as it were, through his ability to interpret dreams, and wound up second in command of all of the land of Egypt, second only to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh had dreams, and the significance of Pharaoh's dream was, Chris? Pharaoh's dream. What did Pharaoh's dreams tell him? What did Joseph say they meant?
It could be 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine.
7 years of plenty followed with 7 years of famine. Famine is a horrible thing. None of us have ever had to endure famine. There are parts of the world today that have endured serious famine, but 7 years? What would 7 years of nothing produce? What would it do to you? It'd be devastating. And what we learn is that this famine extended up into the land of Canaan, strangely enough, where Joseph's family were. Joseph's brothers had to go down to Egypt to bring grain up to the land of Canaan so that their families could survive. They did that twice. We find that eventually Joseph sent for Jacob and all the family to come down into Egypt. How many of them were there about so? About 70 people came down into Egypt. They lived there for a period of time. In fact, after the death of Joseph, before they came out. And when they came out, the Bible tells us that they were great in number. Just how great were they? About 2 to 3 million, scholars tell us. Over 600,000 men of fighting age. That is, men over the age of 20. Now, when you factor in the women and the children, the old men, that sort of thing, scholars tell us that was about 2 to 3 million people that came up out of the land of Egypt. Eventually, we're skipping now the period of wandering, they came into the land that God had described to Abraham that he would give unto him and to his descendants. Now, during all this process, God had a principle rule. You do what I tell you to do, and I'll bless you. You don't do what I tell you to do, and I'll curse you. Now Moses, when he brought the children of Israel up out of the land of Egypt, He told them that very thing. Now, here's where we want to remember our passages. Where are they? Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 24, 25. All right? And Deuteronomy chapter 8, and Deuteronomy chapters 28 through 30. That's right. Joshua then becomes the military leader who's to lead them across the Jordan River into the land and conquer the land. When Joshua brings them into the land, we learn in the 11th chapter, the last couple of verses of that chapter, that all of the land has been conquered. But as Joshua is getting old and about to die, he tells them, you do what God says and He'll bless you. You don't do what God says and He'll drive you out of this good land into which He's brought you. Now where do we read that? Joshua 23, 14 through 16. That's right. Now, what I want to do in our brief review here is to underscore some major passages that tell us this general rule of God. You do what I say, and I'll bless you. You don't, and I'll curse you. Now, when they were brought into the land under the leadership of Joshua, Joshua said, here's the deal. Now, as Joshua died, we read of the period of the judges. The period of the judges covers just over 300 years. Good round numbers to say 300 years of time. How many judges were there? About 15 judges, and that's counting, what's his name? Abimelech? All right, there's a reason why I said that, but be that as it may. As we count the judges, we see a cycle existing among these people. What was the cycle? That's right. Can you imagine different segments, different locations on the map? But can you imagine going around that same horn about 15 times in 300 years? You'd think that you would look at just some recent history and say, I don't think maybe we should do this. But what they would do is to begin to dabble with the idolatrous practices of those that they left in the land. And God would raise up an oppressor. He was doing just exactly what He said He would do. But Moses, way back when he was leading them up out of the land of Egypt, he told them, the day's going to come when you come into that land that you're going to ask for a king. Now here's the kind of king that you need to appoint. And he begins to outline the kind of king that they needed to appoint when they get to that point of rejecting God as their king. And where do we read about the requirements of the king? Back over in Deuteronomy, yes, chapter 17. These are passages now I want you to remember because they're benchmark passages pointing us to something. And indeed, after Samuel, the last of the judges, they came to Samuel and they said, we want a king so we can be like all the other nations. Where do we read about that? Benchmark passage. Where is it? 1 Samuel chapter 8. 1 Samuel chapter 8. Who was the first king to be appointed? King Saul. That's right. What was the disposition of King Saul when he was appointed to be king? Very humble. Very humble. In fact, he considered himself the least, as it were, of his father's house, much like one of the judges did. And when battle arose with the Philistines, we know that King Saul was out plowing, as it were. He was out with the oxen working in the field. You don't normally see a king doing that kind of thing, but he was, expressing his genuine humility. But as Saul grew through a period of time as king, he became very independent. In another battle with the Philistines, we find that King Saul had an army of about 3,000 men. And the Philistines were coming upon him with an army of about 30,000 men. And Samuel said, I want you to go down to Gilgal and wait there. And I'll come and offer a sacrifice, and we'll beseech the Lord on behalf of this battle. That sounds reasonable, doesn't it? So King Saul goes down there and he sees this mass of Philistines. And time passes and Samuel hasn't arrived. And what's now happening to Saul's army? They're deserting. And consequently, Saul said in explaining why he went ahead and offered the sacrifice that I was desperate. Pardon me? I forced myself. Yes, I was desperate. I saw what was happening and I had to do something. Yes, John?
He had a few more. I think it was 1 Samuel 15:5. He had 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people like the sand on the sea.
All right, that's the Philistines. Now, can you imagine an army like that? Yeah, just 30,000 regular in the rank soldiers. Yeah.
I think 30,000
chariots.
People like that.
Yeah, like the sand of the sea. That would be distressing, wouldn't it? But this is what he saw, and he said, I forced myself to offer this sacrifice. What did Samuel say to him when he came? Right on the heels of him doing that. You've done foolishly. Very foolishly. Now, later we see, 2 chapters later, in fact, that was chapter 13, chapter 15, Saul is instructed in 1 Samuel to go and smite Amalek and destroy everything they have. And this is familiar to you. You remember he didn't do that. He brought back the best of the Amalekites, and when Samuel approached him about it, he said, I brought them back to, or rather, the people brought them back to offer them as a sacrifice unto God. Well, did God ask for a sacrifice? No, didn't ask for a sacrifice. Now, when we look at what Saul did, what did Samuel call that? Samuel rebuked him. What did he call it? All right, he called it stubbornness and disobedience. He equated it to the worshiping of an idol. And what was the consequence of what Saul did?
Lost his kingdom.
Samuel said that God's not going to be with you. He's going to take away the kingdom from you. Now, Randy and I have been studying with someone on this particular point, and we know that eventually Saul is about to engage with the Philistines. And he's told by Samuel, we won't go into the how, but he's told by Samuel that tomorrow you're going to be with me. In other words, you're going to be dead. You and your sons. And so it was. When he engaged with the Philistines, Saul was wounded, but then what did he do? He killed himself. He fell upon his sword and killed himself, as well as his armor bearer. But that was the end of Saul. In the interim, we see that David is now appointed as the new king. David's skirts were not lily white, as we use that expression, because he sinned with Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah, the Hittite. He committed adultery with her. And through his plan, he had Uriah the Hittite killed, murdered, if you please. David overall was a good king, but he had some problems with this. And there were consequences that were severe. What was it that God said? What's his general rule? You do what I say and I'll bless you. You don't do what I say and I'll curse you. What happened to David's family? Was cursed. All right. Lost his family. Lost his sons. Yes. We know that he had a number of children. One of them was Amnon. What did Amnon do? Raped his sister. Absalom was another son. What did he do in response to what his brother did? He killed him. That's right. He killed his brother. And Absalom desired to eventually take the kingdom away from his daddy. And so he had a following, and David had to leave the city of Jerusalem, and there was an awful battle, and it was terrible, and Absalom was eventually killed, and the words of David just break your heart. As he said, O Absalom, my son, would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son. You can just hear his heart breaking, can't you? The words that he uses. But what caused all that? Disobedience. Yes, disobedience. Now, as we look at the reign of David, we pass beyond that and we look at the reign of his son Solomon. His son Solomon. Now we know that David had another son who competed for the kingdom instead of Solomon. What was his name? Was it Adonijah? Does that sound right? Adonijah. And Solomon said to his brother Adonijah, it's all right for you to live here and everything will go well if you behave yourself. But Adonijah wasn't content to behave himself. He wanted to have David's wife, which was another attempt to take the kingdom from Solomon. And what did Solomon do? To his brother. Had him killed. That's right, he had him killed. Now what's God's rule? That's pretty simple, isn't it? But here we've got folks not getting that picture. Solomon had a son. What was his name? Rehoboam. All right, Rehoboam. What foolishness did Rehoboam engage in? That's right. He took the advice of the young men instead of listening to the old men. He could have secured the kingdom, would have been good forever, but he wouldn't listen. And so his attitude was, I'm going to be hard on the people and show them who's king. And what happened to the kingdom? Split, divided. And it's from this point forward that we talk about the northern kings as the kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom as the kingdom of Judah. We've got a split here. Now, God had, in 2 Samuel chapter 7, said that He would establish the throne of David. He would establish the house of David. Now, we saw two applications of that. One is that in the lineage of David, right on down, child, grandchild, great-grandchild, right on down, we see kings reigning in Judah who were of the lineage of David. Now you can follow that lineage till you come over here into the New Testament to what character? To Jesus Himself. That's right. And we know that Jesus did not become king of an earthly empire, but He is affirmed by the Apostle Peter in Acts chapter 2 to be exalted at the right hand of God, enthroned, coronated, if you please, as king of His kingdom. He's of the lineage, you see, of David. Now, much to talk about. We'll talk about that later, but let's back up some on our timeline. We've got the kingdom divided. Rehoboam, responsible for the division of the kingdom, Rehoboam continues to be king of the southern kingdom. Who becomes king of the northern kingdom? Jeroboam. And it's at this point folks kind of throw up their hands and say, well, that's complicated. I can't remember those names. Let's not do that. It's not complicated yet. It gets complicated. But it's not complicated yet. But what did Jeroboam do to the people of the northern kingdom? He brought something with him from Egypt where he'd been down there hiding, as it were, afraid of Solomon. He brought back idol worship. Yes. Richard, what'd you say?
Calf
worship. That's right. Calf worship. Put one up here in Dan and one down in Bethel. And the idea was that it's too much for you to go down there to Jerusalem and worship. His fear was losing the loyalty of the people. Now, calf worship. God ever intend His people to worship calves? What has He said? The general rule. You do what I say and I'll bless you. You don't and I'll curse you. Now, when they began to worship idols, what happened to Jeroboam's reign? It could have been established. It could have been a dynasty that would have lasted forever. But because Jeroboam brought back the worship of idols, when his son became king, Nadab, he did evil. And we know then that a man by the name of Baasha killed him and established a new dynasty, a new lineage. Well, Baasha reigned as king for 24 years, and his son Elah became king, and he lasted for 2 years, and he was slain by Zimri. And now we've got the establishment of a new dynasty. That's the end of that family. And when Zimri became king, how long did he remain king in the northern kingdom? A week. You see, he wanted to be king so bad, he killed the man that was king and declared himself king. But the problem with that is, you can't be king unless people are willing to follow you. And people said, no, we don't want you to be our king. Who did they want to be their king? Omri. That's right. So now Zimri is... when I come to that, I always want to say that he was killed. Well, he was killed, but how did he die, Randy?
Burned down the house.
Yeah, that's right. He went in the house, burned the house down over him. And so Omri now becomes king. So we've got this sordid history of kings in the northern kingdom. Omri's son, Ahab, becomes king. Sets a new benchmark for wickedness among the people of God. And when we talk about Ahab's wickedness, it's compounded by that old wicked woman that he married. What was her name? Jezebel. That's right. And where did she come from? Sidon. What'd she bring with her? All right, idol worship. Now you've got Ahab over here that worships idols. And you've got his old wicked wife, Jezebel, that's brought in idol worship. What'd God say? General rule is, you, that's right. And what was it Joshua said? You worship idols and I'll destroy you from off this good land just as surely as I brought you into it. Now, we've got some problems going on here in the northern kingdom. Ahab had a son. And his name was Ahaziah. We haven't talked extensively about his son. We're going to, but I want to continue some conversation with you about the southern kingdom. Now just back up in your mind, we left off there with Rehoboam being king. And we know that he made a very foolish decision. But Rehoboam had a son, and his name was Abijam. Now what complicates things is, he also had another name. He's called Abijah. That's right. So let's not get bogged down with that. But Abijam became king, and he walked in the ways of Rehoboam, but yet he worshiped God. He's still not the best king in the world, but we had another man become king. His son Asa. How would you characterize Asa? Good king, bad king? A good king. He was a good king. Generally speaking, he made some very good decisions, but yet we know that during his time, there was time of peace because of his faithfulness to God, but Asa, in his latter years, began to trust in politics instead of trusting in God. Now, that's not good. His political alliances became very important to him. Later we see that he became diseased in his feet and he trusted in the physicians. And when he trusted in the physicians, trusting in the politicians, he began to wane in his trust of God, and we know that Asa eventually died. Now that brings us to the character that we're currently studying about, and that is his son, Jehoshaphat. That's right, Jehoshaphat. Now Jehoshaphat, good king, bad king. Is a good king, one of the best kings Judah had. But that doesn't mean that everything that Jehoshaphat did was good. Now remember that Jehoshaphat became king in the fourth year of Ahab, who was married to Jezebel. So early on in Ahab's rule in the northern kingdom, Jehoshaphat becomes king in the southern kingdom. And when we look at Jehoshaphat, we see that he did a whole lot of good. I mean, our notes tell us that he received tribute from the Philistines and from the Arabians. But Jehoshaphat began to make some horrible mistakes. We have on the board some that we've talked about, and I want to look at these again in our study this morning. He joined forces with Ahab. Now, what kind of character was Ahab? Good king, bad king? Terrible king. That's right. Why is Jehoshaphat, good king, forming any kind of alliance with Ahab, a very wicked king? Well, we say they had a common enemy. And so your enemy being my enemy makes us friends. Careful. Careful. You see, Ahab is becoming friendly with somebody that is the enemy of God.
Yeah, at that point, he's trusting in numbers rather than God.
He is. Yes, and if we learn anything about Jonathan going back on our timeline to the times of of David, if we learn anything from Jonathan, what did Jonathan and his armor bearer understand?
Oh,
we can scare off just two of us. Yeah, two of us. Going up against an army that's described as innumerable, but yet they could go up against them because God don't fight with numbers. And they were victorious, you see. But now, Jehoshaphat, this is how he's thinking. And so he goes up with Ahab to fight against those Ramoth-Gilead from the Syrians. And that brings us to the text now of 2 Chronicles chapter 17 and 18. And we want to look at that. We know that Jehoshaphat tore down the high places of the Asherim or Asherim, the idol, the female counterpart of Baal, and was a good king. But in this alliance that he formed with Ahab, there were consequences. Now, we talked Wednesday night about how that Jehoshaphat desired to inquire of the Lord regarding this battle with the Syrians. And when he inquired of the Lord, first of all, Ahab presented a number of prophets. And what did all these prophets have to say about this battle with the Syrians? That's good. Go fight. Everything will be wonderful. And Jehoshaphat's not convinced. He said, surely there's one more prophet. Surely there's somebody else we can talk to. And who did Ahab suggest?
Micaiah.
Yeah, we can talk to Micaiah, but I don't like him. You see, I hate him because he never says anything good about me. And then the messengers who went to get Micaiah, they said to Micaiah, what you want to do is to agree with everybody else. Don't be a troublemaker. You say what the king wants to hear. These prophets have said that things are good, so you go tell Mr. Ahab that things will be good. And what did Micaiah do? He went and said everything's good. And then Ahab said, how many times I have to tell you, tell me only what God says. And Micaiah said, things are not going to be good. In fact, if you go to war with the Syrians, you ain't coming back. Now that's how it would be said in Kentucky. You ain't coming back. And Jehoshaphat, for some reason, continues in this alliance with Ahab. Wouldn't you be a bit suspicious? Yes.
He did mention about the fact that Jehoshaphat is also allied with Ahab through marriage now.
Yes. Yes.
That's part of why.
Yes. Yes. That was something they were not to do either, is to hook up with idolatrous women of that consideration because of the consequences. You'll wind up doing what they do. And we saw that overwhelmingly exemplified with Solomon, and certainly we see that here. That's right. Good observation. Yes?
The king wanted the truth, but at the same time, he hated the guy for telling him.
Yeah, well, that makes you wonder just how bad he wanted the truth. Now, Micaiah, when he says to Ahab, if you go up there and battle with the Syrians, you're not coming back, then Ahab said to the servants to take Micaiah and put him in prison and feed him with bread and water. I'll deal with that when I get back. And Micaiah's attitude about that was, if you come back, then I'm not the prophet of God. In other words, you're not coming back. So that's the way that that will be. Now, looking further, we learn that Ahab had a son, and his name was Ahaziah. Jehoshaphat makes an alliance, at least at first, with Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, to make ships. And this sounds good, doesn't it? We'll make ships and we'll send them out here, yonder, and where, and we'll gather gold and silver from the nations round about. And this will be good. And God didn't indicate that would be so good at all. So what happened to the ships? All right, they wrecked. They broke apart. So this did not continue. And then another son of Ahab. I want us to make note of this. Two sons of Ahab. When Ahaziah is dead, Ahab's son Jehoram then sets on the throne in the northern kingdom. And what is it that Jehoshaphat does with Jehoram? Now this takes us back to the account of the kings. And I want you to look at this. We didn't talk about this, I don't think, all that extensively in our last study. But in 2 Kings chapter 3. 2 Kings chapter 3. Again, we've got an issue with a common enemy. 2 Kings chapter 3. And the enemy is the king of Moab. And Jehoram says to Jehoshaphat, much like Ahab had earlier, how about us join forces and go fight against the king of Moab? And what does Jehoshaphat say?
I am as thou art. My people as thy people, my horses as thy horses.
All right, we're one, let's go. Well, that's what he said to Ahab. No. He's making a poor choice of allies here. We need to be careful who our friends are. And Jehoshaphat is allying himself with the enemy of God. Now, as they go to fight against the Moabites, we find that there is an alliance of Jehoram, Jehoshaphat, and the king of Edom. The king of Edom. You see that in verse 8, verse 9. Now the question is asked, which way shall we go? Which way shall we go? Well, the answer was, we'll go up through Edom and approach the Moabites. Now the problem is, we don't have any water. Now if you've got three kingdoms, armies, and their animals, and no water, you got a problem. But Jehoshaphat inquires of Elisha. Now, that comes through the king of Israel, Jehoram. And as he comes to the prophet Elisha, and he presents himself, presents the problem, you'll note in verse 14 of chapter 3, how does Elisha respond to Jehoram? Bad king. King of Israel.
So they wouldn't even talk to him if it wasn't for the fact that Jehoshaphat was there.
Talk to him, I wouldn't even see you. It'd be like looking through you. Wouldn't even know you're there. You see that in verse 14? Were it not that I regard the presence of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, I would not look toward thee nor see thee. But then he gives him instructions to bring a minstrel, and he brings a minstrel. And the answer to this problem is, there's not going to be rain, there's not going to be rivers that are filled by a flood, but God's going to provide for you water. And the water comes from the land of the Moabites. Now, look further at your text, there beginning at verse 21. I didn't read that right, I don't think. I think the water came from the Edomites, yes. Yes, from the direction of Edom.
Okay, thank you.
But when the Moabites approach these three kings and their armies, what do they see? They see all this water, but they don't think it's water. What do they think it is? Think it's blood. What do they think that has happened? All right. These three kings have gotten into it, and their armies have gotten into it, and so they've destroyed each other. So all we need to do is just go in and pick up the spoils. And when they went in to supposedly pick up the spoils, what did they find? Three kings and their armies, very much alive. And what happened to the Syrians? They were wiped out. Yeah, they were wiped out. Now, I mentioned to you that there are some chapters involved here regarding Elisha, the prophet. I'm going to hold that for another study because our purpose here is to look at the kings and see what transpired in the kingdoms. Now we know that Elisha is the prophet. Some fascinating things happen at this point in the life of Elisha, the prophet. But we're going to pass over that. Here's our map when we look at this segment of history. We've got the Ammonites and the Moabites and the Edomites that have banded together against these people who are Israelites. But when we come to chapter 20, let's take the account back now to the Chronicles. Chapter 17 through chapter 21. Chapter 17 through 21. In chapter 20, we've got the Moabites and the Ammonites banding together, and those of Mount Seir, which would be the Edomites, banding together to fight against God's people. And you'll note in verse 3 of chapter 20, verse 3 of chapter 20, 2 Chronicles, it says, "And Jehoshaphat feared and set himself to seek unto Jehovah, and he proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah. And Judah gathered themselves together to seek help of Jehovah. Even out of all the cities of Judah, they came to seek Jehovah." Now, this is one thing you kind of got to underscore as a good thing about Jehoshaphat. We find that when he's about to go to war, he seeks God. Find out what God wants him to do. And when you begin the reading in verse 5 of this text, you see that Jehoshaphat adamantly expresses faith, trust, confidence in God. Randy, if you would please, I'm doing a whole lot of talking, if you would begin and read for me verse 5 through verse 13. That would be helpful, please.
2 Chronicles 25 through what?
13.
Then Jehoshaphat stood in the assembly of Judah and Jerusalem in the house of the Lord before the new court. And he said, "O Lord, the God of our fathers, are you not God in the heavens? Are you not ruler over all the kingdoms of the nations? Power and might are in your hand, so that no one can stand against you. Did you not, O our God, drive out the inhabitants of this land before your people Israel and give it to the descendants of Abraham, your friend, forever? They have lived in it and have built you a sanctuary there for your name, saying, should evil come upon us, or sword or judgment, or pestilence or famine, we will stand before this house and before you, and your name is in this house. We cry to you in our distress, and we will hear and deliver us. Now behold, the sons of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir, whom you did not let Israel invade when they came out of the land of Egypt, they turned aside from them and did not destroy them. See how they are rewarding us by coming to drive us from your possession, which you have given us as an inheritance. Oh, our God, will you not judge them? For we are powerless before this great multitude who are coming against us. Nor do we know what to do, but our eyes are on you. All Judah was standing before the Lord, with their infants, their wives, and their children."
Can you see these that are just perplexed, looking again at the enemy and don't know what to do? But Jehoshaphat's faith in God is expressed very strongly here. In fact, if you drop down further into the text, in verse 20 it says, "And they rose early in the morning and went forth into the wilderness of Tekoa. And as they went forth, Jehoshaphat stood and said, hear me, O Judah, and ye inhabitants of Jerusalem, believe in Jehovah your God. So shall ye be established. Believe his prophets. So shall ye prosper." Question, wasn't that what God had said all along? Going back all the way to the beginning. You do what I say and I'll bless you. You don't do what I say and I'll curse you. That's the general rule. Jehoshaphat's beginning to get a good handle on that. Here's what God said, verse 21. "And when he had taken counsel with the people, he appointed them that should sing unto Jehovah and give praise in holy array. And they went out before the army and say, give thanks unto Jehovah, for his loving kindness endureth forever. And when they began to sing and to praise Jehovah, Jehovah set liars in wait." Some translations use the word ambushments. It says, "against the children of Ammon, Moab, and Mount Seir that were come against Judah. And they were smitten. For the children of Ammon and Moab stood up against the inhabitants of Mount Seir utterly to slay and destroy them. And when they had made an end of the inhabitants of Seir, everyone helped to destroy another." What happened to this coalition between the Ammonites, the Moabites, and the Edomites? They turned against each other. And so the people of God don't have to fight. They have destroyed themselves. And in verse 24, it says, "And when Judah came to the watchtower of the wilderness, they looked upon the multitude, and behold, they were dead bodies fallen to the earth. And there were none that escaped. And when Jehoshaphat and his people came to take the spoil of them, they found among them in abundance both riches and dead bodies and precious jewels, which they stripped off for themselves, more than they could carry away. And they were 3 days in taking the spoil. It was so much." In verse 27, the latter expression says, says, for Jehovah had made them to rejoice over their enemies. Verse 29, and the fear of Jehovah was on all the kingdoms of the countries when they heard that Jehovah fought against the enemies of Israel. And the realm of Jehoshaphat was quiet, for his God gave him rest round about. Now when you look at the text here, you see that victory was given to Jehoshaphat because he believed in God. Now the rest of this chapter runs parallel to what we studied back in the Kings with the desire of Jehoshaphat to make an alliance with Ahaziah and build these ships to go to Tarshish and various places that they might bring back gold and silver and such things. And we know in the last verse it tells us that they were broken so that they were not able to go to Tarshish. This didn't work out for Jehoshaphat. Makes you wonder, why in the world, after such a great deliverance that God gave, why in the world does he want to make an alliance with one of the sons of Ahab? Wouldn't he have learned in making this alliance with Ahab, his father, that this is probably not so good?
I was going to say that's his brother-in-law.
It's now his brother-in-law, yes. We're going to look at that. In fact, where I left off in the last study, jump through some of this, shows us the part of the text that does become quite complicated. And if you want, if you think it will be helpful in your study, these two charts that I put together, send me an email. You can either send it to the church's website address or send it to mine, mgalloway1@juno.com, and I'll send you these so that it will be helpful to you. I've tried to color code some of this to help make it more apparent who is who. Here's the lineage of David, brings us down to Jehoshaphat. Son Jehoram. Here's the lineage of Ahab. Son Jehoram. Jehoram married Athaliah. And they have a son and name him Ahaziah, but Athaliah has a brother also named Ahaziah. You see how difficult this then becomes. And so we want to keep it on track as to who's who, whether they're in the northern kingdom or the southern kingdom, and who their relatives might be, lest we get confused in our reading of the text. It does become somewhat complicated, but we'll begin with these charts next time, Wednesday night. So please be here, and we'll continue our study of the period of time known as the divided kingdom as we continue our study in the development of the scheme of God to save man. Thank you.